introduction. I think most of the poems are short enough. And thank you, Paul, for organizing the Oveo reading set. And it's so successful. And it's my first time here. I'd love it to be here. I sort of divided my reading into three sections. They're sort of loose. The first one is sonnets. After that is food and drink. Not actually, just poems about them. And then love and children. There's only two poems about them. And so, okay, get you some of them anyway. So I'm going to read a few sonnets first. My poetry collection starts off with a series of sonnets actually that are linked together under a sort of loose theme of stories in which something is forbidden, for the story, for the plot line is about breaking or doing the thing which is forbidden. So I'll start with Eve. She's a good person to start with, I feel. This one is called Psalm of Eve. I was dreaming of fire when I heard the apple calling me. Her voice was like water, cool and sweet and wild, quenching my thirst and my dream where an angel was flaming, flowed the voice of the apple, a mother crying out for her child. There was no sound but the cry of the fruit and the breath of the man who slept by me like a brother. We had no children then, and the wail on the wind was the voice of the apple, a child crying out for its mother. I followed the voice to a globe that gleamed under the moon like a beautiful breast on a tree. I am your mother, it said, and my flesh is like milk. Through it, all I know will pass to thee. I reached up my mouth to my mother. What did I know? I have no mother. I wrote a series of poems on the Bluebeard story, one I always particularly liked. I won't explain the details. Anyway, this one's called Bluebeard. When first they caught sight of my beard, all my damned pretty wives were afraid. But my eyes, sharp as axes, could see how my gold seemed to burnish the shade. Between my silk sheets, they said sweetly, it was sapphire or azure or aquamarine. And they swore to be blinded completely to that one room that could not be seen. They never fooled me for a second. It wasn't the bloody key, but the way that they shrank when I beckoned them bedwards, always a dead giveaway. Curiosity killed them. They clawed like cats at the places they knew were forbidden, the curse of their sex. The blood had already drained from their faces when I touched their necks. That's a creepy one. I like writing those ones. And this is another one from the same series called Last Wife. I grew to like his beard, that turquoise mesh, that blue sea washing up on my white flesh. I never thought that I must float or drown, till one room secret weighed my body down. I dreamed that I was trembling on the shore. I dreamed a trickle underneath the door. The walls cried out, the door begged, let me creak. Someday, someone who comes will live to speak. Our house was beautiful, a golden shell. Within its rooms I heard the ocean swell, but at one door at last I understood that deafening tide. It was the roar of blood. The door cracks open with a shriek of pain, a downburst that no finger can contain. This one is from the story of Sion and the Salmon. It's called Finagus. I thought he was a very interesting character because he's the druid who looks for the salmon for most of his life and then is robbed at the last minute. Finagus. Oh, sorry, I'm reading the wrong one. This is called Fire Speaks to Finagus. You came back hungry for your dish of learning to find you had been nothing but bait. 7 years to hook a fish, your day's dreams turning black on a spit, your life a wasted weight. A twisted prophecy stuck in your craw. It said a white-haired man would gain the prize. But even before you looked at Sion, you saw it, that hurting brightness blazing from his eyes. Where is your rage? You too were Sion, were fair, turning away now, turning the other cheek. How is it you could watch all of your share slip from your grasp, which took your life to seek? I'd call a blessing on your torment as you turned, as though there was something greater you had learned. I also wrote some sonnets about Usheen, who came back from Tyrion, but died. Anyway, this is called Usheen. You thirsted for the comfort of old faces, for eyes through which a softer sunlight shines, for speech oaked with remembered shades and places, for vellum skin to read between the lines. You thought you could go back. None of us can. Not in this world where all that lasts is change. Giants dwindle. Every boy becomes a man. When you're estranged, even your home grows strange. Yours was the first death that your wife would know. She begged you not to, knew you had to go. Life's sequence is its shortness, all that's wasted. It cloys too much to be forever young. Shriveling into yourself, at last you tasted the thrill of honey on your dying tongue. And there just be one more sonnet to finish that. This doesn't really fit in with that sequence, but I was made a food series, as Steve said, for RTE some years ago, and I made a program about oysters, and I discovered that an Asian said she visited Ireland, she wrote a diary about the experiences in Ireland. So girls naked from the waist down gathering oysters in Malahide. This is called Oyster Girl. I'd wade in seaweed to my waist and feel the soft suck of the earth out where the teeming waters based their arms that pluck their supper's worth. Where I'd plough my watery acre, shells that strain the ocean hide, spinning otherness to make her, breathing in and out the tide. I'd haul up on the shore at night. My love and I would lie as tight as two halves of an oyster's skin. I'd whisper glimpses of the girls. We'd let each other's strangeness in to harden slowly into pearls. That's the last of the sonnet for a while. So I thought it would be nice to sort of segue from oysters to something that you sometimes drink. But we actually came down here earlier today, so we sampled a pint of Murphy, and then just to keep things equal, we sampled a pint of Beamish. And in Dublin, we mostly drink Guinness. This is called Black Stuff. I grew up near the Guinness houses, Carrick Road, where no river flowed but the Black Stuff, delivered in crates at Christmas to the owl lads, still proud of the good job. Guinness was good for them. Arthur gave them their pension, fed their crate-loaded children from pint-sized to full of bottles, gave girls and boys alike their first moustache, rented them houses till they could buy them out. I like its colour, muddy as the Liffey, the way its black and beige dust smoke separate, settle into coffee and cream, in the time it takes to tell a story, catch your breath, its taste of roast and toast, that first sweet sup warm from the tap. You can't sup beer or lager, that lightness on your lips could never be more than a sip. And porter carried many a conversation still. No beer is so hotly debated, so coldly assessed. The perfect temperature is a keg worth of chat. Even the distance from the barrel is worth mulling over. Last year we found a short path in Tralee, settled like slow pints at a corner table, and parted with the landlady like family. What better drink for your last request? No claret, inking thin glass, or brandy burning in a great balloon could see you off, like the contemplation of those last slow breaths rising and falling till the head stands proud of the body. I'm hoping to get sponsored by Guinness. That one someday. This is a poem about something else. Both of those are Guinness. You figure it out and go along. It's called Contraband. I have smuggled it to England, France, Italy, America, a brown slab wrapped in cling film, taking the space of a holiday read. And indeed it has its share of stories. Each time the baggage x-ray flows, stops. Its operator studies the dense rectangle, tries to read it for herself. It's my mother's brown bread, I say. If I came without it, I'd be dead. There is a dusting of flour underneath so it won't stick to the roasting tins, and only the roasting tins are big enough. The crust is the colour of fudge, the inside a shade paler. It looks solid, but has a soft bounce of air. It conjures up my mother's fingers barely touching the sticky dough. In her head, that's the loosest recipe. Whenever we asked, she said, this one was already thrown together. Something was missing or forgotten. There'd been no buttermilk or oatmeal. When she made it properly, she let us know. The black American security guard calls her colleague over. Once he's sure it is, in fact, bread, he sighs, and asks if I am carrying any other drugs or weapons. I do not carry drugs or weapons, but my knife was always ready when the bread was slid from the oven. In vain, my mother wrapped the steaming loaf in a checked tea towel to try to send us off. You'll garter it, she told us. It won't cut till it cools down. But we each packed a ragged slice, lathered it in cold butter. It'll stick in your craw when it's too hot, she'd say. We'd giggle, asked her where our craws were, and ignore the ache between our lungs where the warm dough lodged. I do not carry drugs or weapons, but the bread contains a mind-altering substance. It distorts your perception of time and place, brings you back 10, 15, 20 years to the kitchen table that smells whole. I do not carry drugs or weapons, but my mother supplies this for free even after you are hooked, and on every journey you are a courier. In England, France, Italy, America, when I share my mother's brown bread, it's familiar as an old book, and old friends ask if I have the recipe yet. I don't think I'll ever manage it. There's some knack to the way the table under our elbows becomes home and the years dissolve in our mouths. This is Slam on the Subject of Food and Travelling. Harry's stepfather, if that's the right word, I'm not sure. Anyway, he had a beautiful deck in Paterson, New Jersey, where he grew the most wonderful peppers. And they've moved away from there since, and I was very worried about peppers when they decided to go to this business called Peppers. When I heard you were moving from Paterson, I worried about the peppers on your deck. People can take roots anywhere, but what about those pale stems weighed with jewels? Creamy moonstones, amethysts ripening to garnet, teardrops of green, tiny orange earrings, globes yellow as a child's sun, small spheres dark as chocolate. You fostered nations, Thai yellow, Chinese red, plucked them like flowers, summer sweet, pretty in purple, flourished them like Cuban cigars, habanero, serrano, jalapeno. In the dim kitchen, they were everywhere, fruit and vegetable, salad, spice, warm as welcomes, sweet as sugar, tear jerkers, mouth fire. The Caribbean people on your block, Dominicans, Black West Indians, felt the sun suddenly tropical as they passed, stopped to marvel at this sudden burst of home. They lifted their faces to your deck, rich as a marketplace, strung with lanterns or beads, each plant a festive tree. Your porch steps drew their homesick feet. They called to bargain or barter, and gently from the tender branches you picked bagfuls of their memories. When I heard you were moving from Paterson, I had a pang for the town of your capstans. I dreamed of the collective name for them, a heat wave, an astonishment, a perplexity of peppers. For the moment, we eke out the bag of chilies, dried to slender pods of red that you poured from a rainbow of jars. Each one can warm a tableful. When I heard you were moving from Paterson, I wished you well in your new home, of course, but I hope your deck has its own weather and warm stems bend with jewels on your porch. Mm-hmm. And travel is a thing I like to do. This is another one. I wrote this about my best friend from Trinity, her farm in France. She lives there now. And the kind of slums that she grows, or green days as we really are called Wren Claude Doré, or Queen, they're called after Queen Claude, Golden Queen Claude, which are quite delicious. Wren Claude Doré. We came to Boga in the heat wave to harvest your green gauges and found the Wren Claude Doré, a queen's ransom in the trees. I felt myself full of promise, a life 3 weeks inside me, Though new, I only told you to turn away your old leaves. On the orchard grass, bitter sweet wind falls, blown down before their time. It has happened twice before, but this time I felt fruitful, sure. Between mornings and afternoons of picking golden fruit, leaping for high branches, stripping them almost bare, we rested in the shade at noon. I sat warm on a fallen tree, with my love, my friend's love, and my child-to-be, with plums like sunshine bursting in my mouth, and thought, this is enough. Sometimes the fruit was sticky, insects had got there first, their entrance marked by a thin trickle of honey. And though kept them overnight cool as the baking dark allowed, their bloom had lost a shade by morning for their trip to the cooperative. Queen Claude would be forgotten except for these small fruits. Her ears a bare 24, her back bent almost double, she could never be as perfect as these gold plums streaked with green, misty like opals, luscious. In the gloom of our summer, I think of your orchard, where for a week we panned for gold in rivers of wren-clawed trees. With nuggets, bitted walnuts, we packed the wooden boxes, our arms and mouths and bellies, so full, so full, so full. To get back to my own back garden, we do actually grow a little bit of food. This one is called rosemary. And I'll read it for Harry. About our first, partly about us, our first time in the garden. The first time we stood in my garden, you admired the rosemary, holding its 100 arms aloft, rubbing shoulders with us, making a charmed circle. You closed your eyes, bruised the stem in your hands, took a long breath, and in the heart of summer, I inhaled winter, incense, all my Christmases. Where rosemary flourishes, you said, the woman rules the house, and somehow it thrives here under my effect. I am grateful for its permanence, glad of its power, and though I need no ointment, salve, or liniment, I only have to reach my arm to find a sprig for my pillow to ward off witches, a tea for headaches, wine for gout, a purseful against plague, an oil to mummify, a torch to purify, a spear for friendship, remembrance, love. My grandmother said rosemary never grew taller than Christ or older than his 33 years. We have 2 decades yet before we know for sure. Meanwhile, it is rich and handsome, and we are rosemary spendthrifts, turning shoulders and legs of lamb into porcupines, to forests of fragrant vines, studding the roast pork, sprinkling the salads, spiking the summer potatoes, stirring it into Italian sauces. In summer, when our daughter is asleep, the garden calls us out. We drink in the last of the light and breathe the incense inching up the wall. Brighter greens come and go, but always it is dark green above, downy grey under, and suddenly a scatter of lilac stars.
I just
read one for Harry, but I'll read another one, which is about our first meeting. We met in the Chester Beatty Library, a beautiful place in Dublin to go, and a nice place to have a meeting place. This is called Meeting at the Chapter Beatty. We have only just met downstairs at the Chapter Beatty Library. We have not touched each other yet. Upstairs, Doris, Adam, and Eve are contemplating each other and the apple. The serpent is already waiting. Upstairs are jars older than Grecian urns, where lover strains towards lover. Fragments assembled, so the hero yearns for the clear plastic mould, a stopgap in scuffed images, whole stories cannot be told. We have not yet become curators of ourselves, guiding each other through halls of memory, reading the small notes by the shelves. You have still time to discover there are whole sequences lost from mine, here or there, a missing line or lover. Upstairs is story within silken story. Silkworms who shot threads like tiny roads were miniature cartographers of glory for emperors who mapped their own silk routes to carry gleaming bolts of gossamer and colours of dreamed forbidden fruits. And we have not yet put our paths to each other, carrying bowls of brightness we've only just met. Upstairs are fabulous creatures with horns and contemporaries on the nature of things, monsters with benign faces, unicorns. Upstairs, Isabella's marriage contract is no seal, though holes gape for a ribbon might thread through. Louis loved another and thought better of a deal that would have sealed up a century of war, blood ribboning between England and Flanders. Love pounded louder than a battle's roar. Everywhere there was love and contract, upstairs in the Chester Beatty library, where we have not made contact. Downstairs, only our eyes have met beneath the weight of silk and history. We have not touched each other yet. Actually, I wrote that for our first anniversary. Sorry, I couldn't believe I had written a poem about it. I had to be together for a whole year. So I had to rush it out for the first anniversary. I'm just going to read one that one of my new friends here tonight mentioned. I'm sorry, I didn't get your name actually. Not Paul.
Shane.
Mentioned I've heard this on Sunday with Melanie, so it's actually an interesting, about an interesting character part that I met in my childhood. It's called Roundabout. The roundabout was the centre of our childish compass. We took our bearings from the four roads it spawned. When people asked the way, it was part of the answer. We crossed it on every journey. Even the direction to our house depended on it, four doors from the roundabout on the right-hand side. It was an island with a real man Friday. At the hub of its wheel, a deserter from the British Army had improvised a tent. Old Tom played house in a bivouac of canvas over sticks and boiled tea in a can with the milk and sugar stirred in. In vain, our mothers warned us not to bag a cup. Tom's tea was our most exotic beverage, fiercely flavoured, black and smoky, the lapsang souchong of our childhood. The roundabout floated up to us like a life belt. Before the traffic was a river in space, we sat on the striped edge and sank our summer toes in the tar lines. When the tar was soft and sticky, we dared ourselves to chew it, scooped fingertips of the melting gum and blackened our mouth in a licorice conspiracy so outlandish it was not even forbidden. The roads clogged up with cars, and old Tom moved to a building site behind the shops. We mourned his loss, saw that change might come. We were a flat earth society, aware that we might fall off the world. The roundabout became our circus ring, where we juggled experience, experiments, excuses. Our show jumping arena, where we pushed imaginary horses through their paces, tested the water jumps, fell at the first hurdle. Our stage, where the lights faded down slowly on summer evenings. As we grew, it shrank away. The roads widened and withered our green circle. A floodlight stole the shadows. Now there are proper places to cross the four roads. Sterile islands with plastic bollards which direct even your eyes away from the abandoned centre, where the ghosts of our small selves are stranded forever in a dream of smoked tea and tarred fingers. And I just, if I have time, I will read. Do I have time? So there's the four. Okay, so this is the one that won the Francis Leonard Award, as you mentioned. A very simple little poem, it's called Scooter, and it's by my daughter Stella. Between our sure steps, you pick your way slowly at first. One foot ticking on the path, the other planted on your new scooter. Quickly, unexpectedly, you stutter into your stride till you are gliding, feet together, just ahead. While we exchange shy smiles of pride, you are suddenly farther on, heart shockingly small beside the open road, a skater on cracked ice where big children knife by on bicycles. There's a flashback to that first crawl when the house bulged with dangers. The fireplace a bludgeon for your head, the table corner a spike for your eye, the kitchen a nerve centre of poisons and avalanches. Now we gasp into a run at your heel of happiness as you round the corner, as we round the corner, watching the gap widening. And I actually just heard today, as I was on my way down here, I got an email from Andrew McFellin, the producer, to say that I have two poems in the new anthology coming out, which two poems that I wrote for Andrew McFellin. And I don't have the other one with me, but I do have this one. It's called Queen of the May. It's a bit inappropriate for this time of year, but thanks for summer coming sometime. Queen of the May. I won't wash my face in the dew at first light. I never had that maiden's skin, rose pink or hawthorn white. Mine is oil and olive, the dawn water would run off me like a mother's warning. I won't feed my grandmother's tissue, the way she kept the May out of the house and crossed herself with who came through the door clutching its starry branches. No, I'll cross the threshold of summer with a bold stride, bringing in stars like a promise of harvest. I'll close my eyes to the shadow of the skies, toss my hips at virgins and fairies, and defy them to deny me my blooming crown, my sweet bouquet, my objet trouvé of summer. I'll heap clusters of flowers on my altar and be my own queen of the May, and I won't believe in anything except that summer is coming and May needs nothing else to be magic. I'll drink wine in the long twilight with my love in the garden, lie in the grass and love freckles onto his skin. I'll dance at his maypole with nothing to lose but my chains of daisies that each say he loves me. Oh, you might as well talk to the wall that's crawling with woodbine again as lay down the law to me, fetchless and restless this summer. Thanks.
The
only excuse for reading this one really is that Con is a very Cork name, and he's also one of the children of Blair. I don't know if they were from Cork, probably not. Anyway, say they were Cork. Very Cork. Anyway, this one. Any excuse. This one is, as you know, the children of Lower turned into swans by their wicked stepmother Aoife, and this is still called Con. He was the youngest of them, some say. They never get it right, those paintings foregrounding four snow-white birds with Aoife seething on the shore behind. We were only children. We sat giddily on one side of the carriage, 8 small feet in a row like a simple sum. Aoife sat opposite with her court shoes in her casket, her eyes bent to a book of symbols. Calculus, she told us when we asked. She certainly was calculating something, a sort of long division of us four from our father, and if she'd known it of herself from him. I'd only begun to stumble through my letters. I could not read her face, but I did wonder after how she thought she could subtract us and multiply his love. She took notes with a quill that scratched our hearts, and the dark plume smoked out of her hat of green velvet. It was the last feather in her cap. And as I was saying about the painting, there were no white swans that day. We started out as cygnets, stains on the green-eyed lake, stubble feathers, the colour of mud or sackcloth. Aoife's face was ashen. Now her long passion had passed, pale in it what she had done. She was the only white thing.